Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. So this is our weekly study of Jewish mysticism, and we started, this is our second series in a discourse that I'm calling The King is in the Field. You guys have a copy? Everyone has a copy of this? Ani Lo Dodi discourse? Okay. So this is a discourse that was taught by the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the year 1966, right around this time of year. Today is Rosh Chodesh El, the first day of the month of El, and this discourse is all about the spiritual energy of the month of El. If you were here 2 weeks ago when we had our first session, so I explained that every Jewish holiday is a moment in time, a moment that is marked like a well that's dug in a certain space through which water comes up from the earth. So every holiday, every special occasion in the Jewish calendar is a moment in time that a certain energy flows to the surface and you and I have access to tap into it. And the energy of the month of El is a very unique energy. I want to begin like this. There are two ways to get out of a negative place. Somebody, if a person's in a bad place, in a negative situation, so there are two ways to get out. So I'll ask you, what are the two ways to get out? Two general ways to get out.
Leave.
To leave, okay, good. So for you to leave, what's the other option?
Not let it bother you.
Absolutely. No. To actually get out, though. No, to actually get out. So the first thing is for you to leave, right, to that bad place. What's the second way?
Get it to leave.
I go back. Okay, what else?
Get the bad place away.
Fix it. What else? Either you leave or
it
leaves. Okay, but what else? Okay, here's the other. Here's what I'm looking for. When I say it, it's going to be so obvious. I'm sorry that it's working out like this morning. Okay. So the other way is that somebody pulls you out. Somebody schleps you out of the bad place, right? So either you leave on your own, or someone else extracts you from the negative place. Sometimes a person can't get out of a situation on their own. They can't. For whatever reason, they might not be able to get out of where they are. So, and that's, you know, physically, spiritually, metaphorically, emotionally, psychologically, whatever that is, right? So a person might be so stuck, they can't get out. So in those situations, it might be necessary for someone outside, to extricate you, or the individual, from that negative place. In general, spiritually, so there's two modalities of divine service. When we talk about connecting with God, which means essentially leaving a place of strict materialism and connecting with God, right? So connecting with God means to leave materialism to a certain extent behind and to interface with God. So when that happens, there's two ways to, or for that to happen, there are two ways in which that can happen. Number one is a person themselves climbs up that ladder to connect with God. That is method number one. Method number two is God swoops down and plucks a person and lifts them up. So we need to contrast these two modalities of divine service. Again, one way is putting in the effort and climbing the mountain. I think I used this analogy in another class recently. One way is you do the effort and you leave wherever you are to climb that mountain and connect with God. In fact, prayer is referred to as the ladder, a sulam, a ladder, the ladder of prayer. Why is it referred to as a ladder? Just like a ladder, you know, you get from the ground to, you know, high up, you get there not with one jump, but you get there incrementally, step by step, with a ladder. The same thing is true with prayer. Prayer allows us to reach the greatest heights, but we do so step by step. In fact, you know, the famous dream of Jacob, where he has a dream as he's leaving the land of Israel, he dreams of a ladder, and on the ladder there are angels going up and angels coming down. So it's taught in Kabbalah that this ladder is the ladder of tefillah, the ladder of prayer. And that's why the angels are going up and the angels are coming down. The angels are carrying up our prayers, because the question is, why don't the angels come down first? Right? If angels start off on high, so they should be described as coming down the ladder and then going back up the ladder. Why is it described in the Torah as going up and going down? Are you with me on this? Yes? Why is the order first going up and then going down if we're talking about angels which start off on high? So it's explained in Kabbalah, these are not angels that start off on high. These are angels that you and I create through our prayers. So when we pray, we create an angel that also carries up the prayers, the tefillot. And it carries it up, and then it brings down the blessing, brings down the influence from above in return. So those are the angels up and the angels coming down. The point is that it's explained in Kabbalah that there are four rungs to the ladder of prayer. So when you open up the Siddur, the Jewish prayer book, so it won't specify exactly. You might not see in your average prayer book clearly delineated step one, step two, step three, step four, although maybe you should. Maybe we should have, we should put that in there. But there are four steps to the prayers. The opening verses of praise. There are various steps of the prayers, and the point is that through these steps of prayer, we become more mindful of God and less mindful of ourselves. We think a little bit less about the bank account and a little bit more about our Creator, step by step by step. So that's us climbing and getting close to God. There's another way to get close to God. And that is not through our own efforts, but through God swooping in and plucking us from where we are and taking us to somewhere great. One method is driven by personal effort, and one is driven by divine intervention. So the former is you and I climbing that ladder. It takes hard work. If we talk about prayer, you have to show up, and then you have to grab a prayer book. You have to think about it. You have to say it. You have to feel it. It's an experience, and it takes step by step. And if you miss a rung, you may fall down. It's a methodical process, step by step, and it requires effort. The second, the latter form, where suddenly you wake up one day and God sends a message of inspiration and you don't even know why you're inspired, but suddenly you're inspired to change something about your life. So that comes easily without effort. So Kabbalah compares and contrasts these two modalities: the inspiration born of human effort and the inspiration born of divine intervention. And what the analogy that I'll use is that it's the difference between studying for a test or getting the answers for the test. You with me on this? Okay. If you have a cheat sheet, if you have the answer key, better than a cheat sheet, if you have the answer key to the test, let's say it's a standardized test, 100 questions, and you know, it's one of those, you know, I don't know if they use this anymore. It's been a while. Huh? Do they do the number two pencils? They still do the number two pencils. Okay, great. Whew. Safe. No, it's not digital, right? It's not like touch screen or whatever. Okay, number two pencils. So but you have the answer sheet, right? So you have the answer sheet. So now it's like, yeah, B, C, A. It's like super easy. Boom, 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 boom. You don't have to look at the questions. You got the answers. So assuming the answer sheet is correct, and assuming you follow the answer sheet correctly, what is your grade? 100. You aced it. What if you leave it to your own? What if you leave it up to your own devices? In other words, what if you don't base it on the answer key, right? What if you answer the question solely based on your knowledge? You don't have an answer sheet, right? You don't have that answer key. You're basing it solely off of what you know, and you know it pretty well. What are you gonna get?
Maybe 100,
but maybe you'll get 90,
60, 70.
60, 70, 80, right? It could be any of those decades, right? It could be anything. It could be any of those scores. Who knows? What's the difference? The difference is like this. When it's up to your own effort, you may not get as high a grade as if it was coming from an outside source, i.e. the answer sheet. When it's coming from the outside source, you're going to get a higher grade. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, when you have the answer, when you have the answer sheet, right, it's not you. It's not your effort, and therefore it doesn't at all reflect your accomplishment and your knowledge. This test, these results, don't at all reflect how much you know and how much you don't know. And therefore, if it's a test that also has real-life application, and that real-life situation comes up, and you need to know the answer that was on that test, but you never learned it because you had that answer sheet. So you filled in the answer, but you never learned the information. But now the question comes up in real life. Do you have the skills to implement that knowledge? The answer is no, you don't, because you never learned it. But when you learn it, even if it's not perfect, what you learned, you learned. It's yours. You own it. And therefore, if it comes up or whatever, you can apply it. You know it because you have it. It's yours. You own it. So Kabbalah explains that there are two forms of inspiration. One is self-generated and one is externally administered. So the self-generated inspiration, which is known as milmata lemaila, which means from below to above, it's us climbing the ladder, it's not 100%. You're not going to ace the test. No human being is perfect, and our inspiration is never 100%. It's never going to be full, absolute dedication to God, dedication to purpose. It's never going to be perfect. But the one thing it has going for it is that it's ours. When you and I climb that mountain or climb that ladder, it's you and I climbing that ladder. What we accomplish is wholly and completely ours. Whereas when we become inspired from an external stimulation, right? We become inspired from something outside of us that in a sense reaches down and lifts us up. So it might be 100% inspiration because it's coming from God. So it's like a pure, perfect jolt of energy and inspires us deeply. The drawback, though, is that it's not us. It's not ours. And what can happen is, as easily and quickly as it arrived to us, it can also depart from us, this measure of inspiration. So the way it works is, what you've earned is yours to keep. What has been given to you, you can use as long as you have it. But as soon as it disappears, it's gone. So the example that we can use, another example is, again, in addition to the test example, it's riding a wave, right? You're surfing and a wave comes along. You're surfing or you're paddleboard, whatever it is, you're on the ocean, and then a wave comes and suddenly you're lifted up. Is it you? Is it you that's lifting yourself up? No, of course you have to paddle alongside, you have to do your, I'm not a surfer, whatever it is that you need to do. But it's not you. It's not you. The moment that wave crashes, you come down as well to the average height that you are at. So when it comes to inspiration, there are moments of inspiration that lift us up and raise us like the crest of the wave, but then they come crashing down. And when they come crashing down, a person can find that not only are they back to where they started, but they might feel even lower than when they started. So the Kabbalistic texts talk about people who become very inspired for a week, for a day, for a week, for a month, even for a year. And they're spiritually on fire. And they're all into their spiritual practice and into prayer and into all of these wonderful things. And then after a while, or a short while, a long while, the inspiration completely disappears and it fades. And they wonder, what went wrong? Like what happened? And so it's explained in the discourses is that what happened was this was never the person. This was never their own effort. It was them being lifted up by divine inspiration. It might have been for a while, but it was all externally driven. It was some sort of divine inspiration intervention that lifted up the person. And the moment the inspiration dissipated, the moment it left, the person finds themselves back to where they started, and it feels worse than before. Because before you didn't know what this felt like, and now that you know what it feels like, to crash after the high feels really low. It feels lower than it was before. Even if it's objectively at the same spiritual level as one was before they were lifted up, it feels much lower. It feels much lower because they've tasted the sweetness of spiritual connection. And now they don't have it, or they're not feeling it right now. So it feels even lower. Number one, it's the contrast. Number two, it's expectation. On many different levels, it can feel lower than objectively where it is. And so the mystics ask the question, so what happened? What went wrong? And the answer is, as I'm explaining, is because it was never yours. It was just taken away. You were granted a gift for a certain amount of time, and then it was taken away. Someone deposited extra funds in your account, and you're like, wow, I'm rich. And then the bank said, whoops, it's a mistake. Not that it's a mistake, but we're going to take those funds back out of your account. They're not yours. They're not yours. But you earned it. You didn't earn it. It was a deposit. Okay, so while it was there, it was nice to have a padded bank account. But now the illusion's over, right? The magic has worn off. Now you're back to where you started. And that feels very low. So therefore, the Kabbalists really advocate not to live by and to hope for this inspiration from above. To bank on getting these types of spiritual interventions and spiritual inspiration from above, to bank on that is not a wise way of living. Rather, the true way to conduct our spiritual lives is to assume that whatever it is that we wish to achieve, we are going to have to accomplish on our own. In other words, we are going to have to strive and work hard for what it is that we want to attain. So the two phrases, I want to give you the terminology in Kabbalah, because I think terminology is important. You'll have a frame of reference. So these two modalities are either referred to as Milmata Lamaila and Milmata Lamaila and Milmaila Lamata. I know it sounds almost the same twice, but let's break it down. Milmata Lamaila means from below to above, which means that you and I are climbing from below to above. That's our effort. We're rising above. Milmaila Lamata means from top down, from above to below. That is the divine inspiration that comes down and then lifts us up. That which is produced, that which is generated from below to above, Milmata Lamaila, from below to above, that is real and that is lasting and that you and I own. What you and I have accomplished is ours to keep. The effort that you've put in, that no one can ever take that away. That's yours. So the Milmata Lamaila, the from below to above stuff, that is owned by us. The Milmaila Lamata, the from above to below inspirations, the ones that the sudden moments of, you know, wow, let me do something amazing. I feel excited. I feel good about life. All of those, you know, external stimulation, the spiritual excitement and the spiritual intervention, all of that that comes from above to below, that easy come, easy go, that can dissipate and leave us completely back to where we started and perhaps feeling even lower than when we started. So that's not, I'm going to use a word here and understand the context, it's not real. When I say it's not real, I don't mean it's not real while it's happening. What I mean is it's not real in the bigger picture. It's not us. It's not us. It's something else. It's not us. So it's not real. Real in the sense that it's that we own it. We don't really own it. So the Kabbalists talk about this in the context of many different things, including the holidays. Passover. Would you consider Passover, the Exodus, a below to above, a Mamata Lamaila experience, or a Mamaila Lamata, or above to below experience? Why would you say above to below?
Because it was a gift for the seed of, you know, for everything to happen for us to be able to get out. We couldn't have done that on our
own. Right. Ask a simple question. Did we get ourselves out of Egypt? We didn't. We couldn't. How do we get out of Egypt? God intervened. Straight up. Intervention. God facilitated, God created 10 plagues. He got us out. He split the sea for us, gave us the Torah. The entire Exodus experience, before, during, and after, it's all marked by the modality of above to below. God gave us a gift, the gift of freedom. Here's the problem. No gift. If it's a gift, then it's not ours. We don't own it. We didn't earn it. And it doesn't typically last. So, but that's what happens the month. So that's what happens at Passover. Passover is the inspiration from above. It's God giving us gifts. It's God lifting us out. It's God doing the heavy lifting. It's coming from above to below. Whereas the high holiday season, which we're entering right now, the month of Elul, and then the month of Tishrei, it's marked by the complete opposite form of divine service. The month of Elul that we're beginning today, today is Rosh Chodesh, today is day one of Elul. So it's a very important day. This day begins what is known to be a fairly rigorous process of introspection. It's a day in which we begin to look at ourselves and take stock. The example that's given is if you own a business. So the business that's going, you're buying, you're selling, you're moving, you're shaking, whatever it is that you do in the business, right? So you're doing the business. Every so often, you need to take a step back and do an accounting. Are we making a profit? Are we selling what we need to sell? Is the merchandise in the inventory sitting? You know, what is selling? What's not selling? What's good? What's not good about the business? How can I make it more profitable? Every so often, you need to make an assessment and do an introspective assessment an audit of the business and say, well, what's going on here? Is this working or is it not working? Elul is the month of personal auditing. It's the month in which we all look within ourselves. No one tells us, you know, what it is. It's us to ourselves, as honest as we can be. We look at ourselves and we ask ourselves the questions. What am I doing well? What am I not doing so well? What can I improve on? What areas should I enhance? What areas should I stop doing? What's working? What's not working? Where is it profitable? Where is it not profitable spiritually? What relationships are healthy? What are unhealthy? What aspects of my Jewish life are connected or not so connected, etc.? So it's a month of introspection, and we begin to lay the foundation for positive resolutions for the new year. So once the calendar strikes 5779, in 30 days, in the first day of Tishrei, in the next month, so 30 days from now or so, give or take, right? So 1 month from now, when the calendar changes to the new year, we're already in a place where we are different than where we entered this month of Elul. In other words, we've already taken on the positive resolutions. We've started to move ourselves in a more positive direction for the new year. Understand this simple point. This experience of the high holiday season, i.e. the month preceding the holiday season, and to a certain extent the high holiday season itself, it's all marked by our personal work. It's effort from us. It's not a gift from above. It's not like God saying, oh, here, come along, let me take you out of Egypt. No. This is you and I doing the heavy lifting, climbing step by step, day by day, out of where we're perhaps a little bit stuck and getting to a better place. Which is why the Kabbalists tell us that the month of, or the holiday of Passover, the month of Nisan, is top down. It's above to below. Exodus, above to below. God gave us that gift. The month of Elul and Tishrei, it's all marked by below to above. And it's reflected in the letters that we call these months and seasons in the Hebrew. In the Torah portion yesterday, we read about Passover. And the Torah yesterday, in the Torah portion of Re'eh, tells us that Passover occurs in the month of, what is the month called in yesterday's Torah portion? It's called Nisan, but what did the Torah refer to it yesterday? Aviv. Chodesh ha'aviv. The month of spring. Aviv means spring. The springtime month. Okay? But look at the Hebrew word aviv. Aviv is spelled Aleph, Bet, Yud, Bet. But look at the first two letters. Aleph, Bet. That is the order of the letters, right? Aleph, Bet, the alphabet. The Hebrew alphabet is Aleph, Bet. In other words, it's in the forward-facing, front-facing order of the letters. Aleph and then Bet. That's for the Exodus. What about Tishrei, the high holiday season, the month of Tishrei? It's Tav, Shin, Resh. The last letter, the second to last letter, the third to last letter. Those are the three last letters, and it's in reverse order. It would be helpful if we had an alphabet chart. You know what? We can get an alphabet chart in just a moment. Moshe, you pass a siddur, please. I'll show you. I'll hold up the siddur. There's an alphabet chart, and you'll see what I mean. Please pass it around. Thank you. Okay, check this out. So this is the alphabet chart, right up here. So Aleph, because Hebrew is read always right to left. So you have Aleph and then Bet. So this is Av, or Aviv. Aviv is like Aleph, Bet, then Yod, and then Bet again. But anyway, at least the first two letters move forward in the sequence of the letters. Whereas Tishrei is Tav, Shin, Resh. It's the reverse order of the letters. In other words, one is, if you put the letters vertically, if you listed the letters vertically, so Aleph Bet is top down, and Tishrei, Tav, Shin, Resh is below to above. So this indicates in the letters of the names that the holiday of Passover, the Exodus, the month of Nisan, etc., in general, it's associated with top down inspiration. God says, you're stuck. I will get you out. I will bust you out of this place. Come with me. I didn't work for it. I didn't earn it. I don't own it. Doesn't matter. God frees us. God pulls us out of that dark space. That's Passover. This month, this high holiday experience, it's not about God pulling us out. It's about us pulling ourselves out. It's about us thinking about where it is that we are, where we need to be, where we'd like to be, and how to get there, and setting a plan and implementing the plan. It's about us literally doing the hard work. It's below to above. It's climbing the mountain. Kabbalah teaches, when God does the pulling, it's like the answer sheet on the test. It's 100%. The high is so high. When God pulls you up, that high is the ultimate high. You can't get higher than when God pulls you up. You can't. Because it's coming from God himself. When we pull ourselves up, when you and I pull ourselves up, we're never going to get 100%. A human being will never get as high spiritually on their own as when God pulls you up. So you're going to get 90, if only, right? Halavai. 80, 70, 60, 50, whatever it is. You're never going to get as high. You're never going to get as high when you are climbing the mountain yourself as opposed to being airlifted to the top. You're never going to get as high. However high you get, it's you. In other words, even if it's only 50 or 60 relative to the 100, doesn't matter because it's you. And what you have is what you've earned. And it's yours to keep. As opposed to being at 100%, but it's not even you. So with 100%, you can slip right back down to zero, back down to where you were. If zero is the starting point, I don't mean zero. No, not. If zero is the starting point, 100%, you can go right back down. Whereas when you climb, you have what you have. So these are the So these are the pros and cons of both approaches. When God is doing the heavy lifting, the pro is it's really high. The con is it's not you. When you lift yourselves up, when you and I climb ourselves, so the pro is that it's ours, the con is it's never going to be as high. Does it make sense? Yes? Okay. Let's pass around these sheets. Supplementary materials. And we start off with a verse from Shir HaShirim. Song of Songs. I mentioned last time this is one of the most famous verses from Song of Songs, from Shir HaShirim, authored by King Solomon. Just so everyone's on the same page here, King Solomon wrote Song of Songs as a love story, but the way it's understood by classic Jewish literature is that it's not just a love story between two human beings. It's a love story between us and God. So we are in love with God, and God is in love with us. And the drama, the story of Song of Songs, is how that relationship unfolds. The good times, challenging times, but ultimately the undying, the unrelenting love that exists between the soul and God. The soul is referred to in the feminine and God in the masculine in the song. So if there's a he, it's God. If there's a she, it's the neshama. Neshama, which means soul in Hebrew, is a feminine word. The soul is usually referred to in the feminine. So one of the more famous verses right here, Song of Songs, chapter 6, verse 3, says, Ani ledodi vedodi li. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. On a simple level, it is the bride speaking about her groom, and she's saying, I am dedicated to my groom, and my groom, he is dedicated to me. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. There's another verse that says the opposite. There's another verse in Song of Songs that says exactly the opposites. My beloved is mine, and I am my beloved's. So what's the difference? Who is initiating? Who is reaching out first? In the current verse that you have in front of you, the implication is, first, I reach out to my beloved, and then in response, my beloved reaches out to me. So I initiate, and my beloved reciprocates. The other modality is, my beloved is mine, my beloved initiates, and then I am my beloved's, and then I respond. These two verses are exactly the same paradigm, fall into this exactly the same paradigm as what we've been discussing until now. The verse that we have, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, this verse evokes an Elul Tishrei dynamic where we are doing the heavy lifting. We are the ones approaching God. God is not approaching us and saying, let me take you out of that challenge. Let me rescue you from where you're stuck. That's not what Elul is. Elul is a person saying, I am going to get close to you, God. No matter how much effort it takes, I am going to climb that mountain. That's what Elul is all about. Elul is us reaching out to God. It's not God reaching out to us. Nisan, Chodesh Aviv, Passover, is Dodi Li Va'ani Lo. That's when my beloved reaches out to me, and then I reach out in response to my beloved. That is initiated from above. The Passover experience is God saying, come here, guys. Y'all are stuck. See that? I'm speaking Southern. You guys are stuck. Come on, sort of. Come on out. Let's go. I'm taking you out of here. We're busting out of Dodge. That's it. Forget it. Say goodbye to the Egyptians. You can walk like an Egyptian if you want, but we're out of here. That's what Passover is about. That's Dodi Li Va'ani Lo. That's my beloved is to me, my beloved is mine, and I am to my beloveds. I am my beloveds. That's God initiating and us reciprocating, us following along. Okay, where are we going? Let's go, I guess. We're out of here. That's Passover. Tishrei, Elul and Tishrei is us initiating. It's us saying, God, we want you. We want a relationship. We want to be connected with you. We are willing and ready and prepared to do the effort, to put in the effort it takes to achieve that relationship. So that is Ani Ledodi Vedodi Li. So last time, we explained the following. And this was, so if you open up now the discourse booklets, everyone has a copy? Yes? Okay. So the discourse begins, at least in this printout, on page 331. And he quotes from the Rebbe in 1966, quotes from a discourse authored by the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad. It's printed in this book called Likutei Torah, on the Torah portion of Re'eh, which is yesterday's Torah portion. And he explains, based on the earlier discourse, that the Hebrew letters that comprise the month of Elul, right? So the month of El, today is the first day of Elul. Elul is Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed, Elul. They form the first letters of the four words, Ani, Ledodi, Vidodi, Li. The first letters of those four words, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, Ani, Ledodi, Vidodi, Li. If you look on the handout, I even bolded those first letters of each of the Hebrew words. I am my beloved's, Ani, Ledodi. The Aleph and Lamed are bolded, Vidodi, Li, and the Vav and the Lamed are bolded. So those four letters put together, Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed, form the Hebrew word Elul, which is the month that we're in now. In other words, the month of Elul is marked by us approaching God. It's not God rescuing us. It's us approaching God. Here's the problem. Here's the problem. The problem is that if this is true about the month of Elul, that it's all about us approaching God, then why is it called Elul? It should just be called El. Because what is the Ul of Elul? What is the Vidodi Li? My beloved is mine. It's God connecting with us. If the month of Elul is about us climbing to God, it's from below to above. So why is the Vidodi Li, the second half of the verse, when God reciprocates, why is that mentioned in this month or in this verse? I'm going to explain this question much better. Let's do this. The way the Alter Rebbe explains it in Likutei Torah, in the original discourse, is the following. In the month of El, we do the hard work climbing up the mountain, getting close to God. And then when the high holiday season comes around, when Rosh Hashanah comes around, Yom Kippur comes around, then we get that inspiration from above, we get that jolt from above that lifts us even higher. So first we initiate, for 30 days we climb and climb and climb. We don't get any, you know, no lightning, no thunder, no magic, nothing. We don't get any divine inspiration. It's all us doing the heavy lifting, 30 days of heavy lifting. And then in response to that, then God sends down all of the beautiful spiritual energy of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. You feel inspired and uplifted from above. There's magic in the air. That comes as a response to the effort that you and I put in the preceding month. So Elul, we put in the work, and then Tishrei, the next month, we receive the results of that effort being lifted up. In addition to our climbing, we also get lifted up, or we feel that inspiration from above in addition to what we've climbed on our own. If that's the case, then the question is, why does the month of Elul itself include the letters that form the acronym for the second half of the verse, that my beloved is mine? If Elul is really only about us, I am my beloved's, then why is the second half of the verse, and my beloved is mine, also part of the phrase that's included in the word of Elul? So the basic explanation is because it's the work that we do in this month that allows us to appreciate what's going to happen in the next month. But the Rebbe in 1966 is not happy with his explanation. And he says, if the second half of the verse, my beloved is mine, which form part of the word Elul, it's the Vav and the Lamed, it's the second half of the word Elul, if it's part of the word Elul, it must be that my beloved is mine also exists in this month as well. And the question is, how can it exist? Let's read this question inside. So turn to page 332. So let's do the second paragraph in the English. We did this quickly last time. Let's start over here and let's pick it up, and then we're gonna further it. So he says, thus the letters of the name Elul serve as an acronym to the entire verse, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. And look at the brackets, the next paragraph, i.e., even the phrase, my beloved is mine, which refers to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, is included in the acronym for the letters of Elul. Why? For the arousal from below in Elul, I am my beloved's, also serves as a preparation for the drawing down and revelation of godliness, my beloved is mine, on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Since our efforts on Rosh Hashanah are what generate our the gift that we receive on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, in other words, what we do on Elul precipitates what we get on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, therefore even what we get on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is included in the verse that we collectively call Elul, because Elul is setting the tone for what happens following Elul. Does this make any sense? Yes? Ish? Sort of? Ish? Ish? A strong ish? Basically, the way he's dividing it initially is Elul is climbing the mountain, and Tishrei, in other words, the next month, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, is when God sends down inspiration from above, following what we've done. In that case, Elul should just be El, Ani Ladodi, and Tishrei should be Ul, right? Vidodi Li. So this month should just be I, my beloved, and next month should be my beloved is mine. Why is the whole thing, why is Ani Ladodi Vidodi Li Elul, why is I, my beloved, and my beloved is mine in this month? He says the only answer we can give is if we're saying that the result of our effort, the inspiration that we get from on high in the month of Tishrei is generated by what we're doing here in this month. So therefore, this month also includes what we're getting later. It's almost like since it's being earned. I'll give you an example. Somebody lights a fire. And the fire, and they're negligent with the fire. You know, there's fires burning in California right now. So somebody lights a fire and is negligent with the fire. And the fire ends up burning down houses and farms and whatever it is, causing tremendous destruction. Is the person that lit the fire liable or not? Yes? Everyone agree with that? You think that person should be liable? I'll ask you a simple question. Did they burn down the house? The house that eventually burnt down. They lit a fire, right? They lit a fire in a forest and eventually burned down all these forests, and it also burned down houses. Did they burn down the house? How did they burn the house? They lit a fire. They lit a twig on fire. But what did they do? They just lit this thing on fire. They didn't light the house on fire. So what? They didn't light the house on fire. By the way, I agree that they're liable. I'm just trying to get you to think why. Why are they liable? What's the construct? How do you associate liability for that with this?
They started the fire.
They did the initial action.
Okay. In other words, what we say legally is that anything that will unfold from this is attributable to your actions. And not only that, anything that will eventually unfold, it's almost like it happens in that first moment of the action. Are you with me? Even if it hasn't unfolded in time, when it unfolds in time, you can say that all of that indeed occurred in that first moment. Does that make sense? I'll ask you another question. If you say that when you light a fire, then anything that happens afterwards, it's your liability, how are you allowed to light Shabbat candles? Right? So we know we light Shabbat candles before sunset because you don't want to light a fire on Shabbat, so you light it before. How does that help? If when something burns, it's considered as if you're burning it, right? You just told me that that if somebody lights a fire and a day later it burns down a house, it's still that person that's burning down the house, right? You all agree with that, right? Okay, so you light Shabbat candles, let's say sunset is 6, let's just say. So you light Shabbat candles at 5:45, okay? You light Shabbat candles at 5:45, and they're burning for 2 hours, which means 7 o'clock they're burning. 7 o'clock is Shabbat. Who's burning that candle now?
I don't understand the question. What's the question?
What's my question?
You light the Shabbat candle at 5:45.
Yeah. Still lit. So my question is, who is burning the candle? Who's lighting? Who is kindling the candle right now? I know it's still burning, but who is considered to be the one behind it's burning right now? You. Right?
It's Shabbat.
It's Shabbat, and you're not supposed to light, like, you're not supposed to kindle fire on Shabbat. So how do you have a candle still burning on Shabbat? In other words, if you say liability means, I just want to explain this. If you say that when it comes to arson, that your action, it's like you are, at every moment, it's you lighting it again, you lighting it again, you lighting it again. That's why you're liable for the house that burns down a day later, because it's like you're lighting it. If that's how you understand fire, right, the relationship between the starter of the fire and the fire itself, that at every moment, the initiator of the fire is lighting it again and again and again, if that's how we understand fire, which is why you're liable when the otherwise, why are you liable when the house burns down?
Well, one's causing destruction.
Doesn't matter, doesn't matter. Why are you liable? Look, let's look at action. Let's look at action.
You're calling to be an attorney.
Well, no, so here's the question. It's a very simple question. I did one action. I lit a twig on fire. That's what I. That's the immediate thing that I did. Don't tell me that it went and burnt down a house. I did not burn down. This is the defense argument. I did not burn down a house. I lit a twig on fire. That's all I did. What is wrong with that defense? Why can't a person, why wouldn't the court say, oh, you're right, you know, you just lit a fire in this corner of the forest. You're right, whatever happens, it's not you. You just lit this one individual fire. We don't say that. We say rather that because you started it, every inch that it burns is you lighting it. You lit this, and then you lit that, and then you lit that, and then you lit that, and then you also burnt that house down. You did it. Even though you can say, I didn't do it, I just lit this one thing on fire. The law says, of course you lit everything on fire, because it only burned because you lit that first thing. So every moment of the way, every step of the way, was you burning it.
Right. And that's why they have that point that there are certain guidelines you have to follow before you light it.
Right, and that's why if you have a campfire, you have to put it out, and it has to be totally out and not warm. 100%. Why? Because if you are negligent with it, the law will find you culpable. It will find you guilty, liable, responsible for every inch of destruction. Even though you only lit a small thing directly on fire, every single thing that burned, it's like you burned it again and again and again. It's like you took your match or your lighter, you burnt this, you burnt this, you burnt this, and then you burnt that house down. But it's more than just a chain reaction. The law says it's not just a chain reaction. The law says that you burnt down the house. It's direct. You burnt it down. So my question is, if you are burning every moment, every step of the way, if that's what you're doing every step of the way, then when you light Shabbat candles, you're burning it every second. You're burning the candle again and again and again and again. Every inch of wax that it destroys and consumes, you are burning, which means you are lighting fire. You're kindling fire on Shabbat. Correct. But my question is like this. If there's no difference between starting the fire and the fire continuing in the context of your connection with it, correct? In other words, there's no difference whether I started with the house or whether I started with a twig and it ended up burning down a house. It's still like I did it. If that's the case, because I am doing each and every step of the way, then I am lighting fire on Shabbat. The only allowance, the only reason why you're allowed to light Shabbat candles, and it's not considered like you're lighting the candle on Shabbat, is because we consider that anything that unfolds retroactively goes back to moment one. In other words, what we take is the expanse of time of the fire, we roll it back, roll it back, roll it back into that first moment, and we say, in the first moment you have done, in that moment, everything that is going to happen, and we don't know yet what that is, but anything that will happen, you have done in that first moment. In other words, it doesn't mean when we light fire, according to Jewish law, it doesn't mean that you're lighting it again at each moment. It's you. No, you lit it once. But that initial lighting includes all of the destruction and devastation and burning and consumption that will eventually unfold, which is why we are allowed to light Shabbat candles. Because although it's still burning on Shabbat, all of the eventual burning and consumption, etc., and destroying the wax or the oil, whatever it is, all of that the stuff that will unfold, is considered to be rolled back in that initial action. In other words, you consider the result and the consequence to exist in that first moment of the action. So although it hasn't played out in time yet, conceptually, spiritually, in reality, we consider that at that moment, it includes everything that will happen, which is what he's saying here with El. Although Rosh Hashanah hasn't happened yet, and Yom Kippur hasn't happened yet, and we haven't been blessed with that inspiration from above, the moment you and I put in the effort in the month of Elul, it's as though those things have already happened. And the inspiration that will come down in the next month as a result of our effort now, it's all considered as though we're generating it now from the beginning, retroactively. So whatever will be the result of this action, it's all considered as though it's happening now in this moment that we're taking action. So although Elul is a month in which we lift ourselves up to God, and the following month, the month of Tishrei, is the month in which God comes down to us, that coming down also is included in the month of Elul because these actions precipitate those actions. And therefore, we look at the results and the consequences to be rolled into the initial action. Just like we do legally when it comes to fire. So when it comes to fire, we say, whatever it's going to burn, it's like you already burned it from the beginning. It's the first moment you burnt the whole forest, and you burnt all those acres and all those homes. You did it. No one else did it. Don't blame the wind. Don't blame anything else. You lit it. You're on the hook for anything that's going to happen. It rolls all the way back to that first action. So too, in a positive way, all of the beautiful spiritual lights that are born of our efforts in the month of Elul, eventually that will come down to us, radiate to us, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the high holiday season, all of that we consider to be generated by our efforts in the month of Elul, which is how he explains in a very simple brackets over there, which is how he explains why the month of Elul, the acronym for the month of Elul, includes both I am to my beloved and my beloved is mine. It includes both sides, both parts of the equation, because even the second half of the verse, which talks about God's radiance from above down to us, it's also generated by our actions in the month of Elul. What will eventually come next month is considered to be a product of what we do this month. Therefore, this month includes both this month and next month's response. I hope this makes more sense now. That's the best I'm going to be able to do with this. Now, last paragraph on 332. He questions this, and this will open up incredible new vistas. Explanation, however, is required. The fact that the letters Vav and Lamed, which allude to the second half of the verse, which is my beloved is mine, the fact that these letters are part of the acronym for Elul, let's continue to page 333, indicate that Elul is not just a preparation for the drawing down of godliness alluded to by the phrase my beloved is mine, but that the revelation of my beloved is mine is also manifest within the month of Elul itself, and not only afterwards on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. What he's saying here is, although this explanation might work with arson and with fire and with a legal technicality, the reality is when we talk about the avoda, the service, the work of the month of Elul, if Elul is the acronym for the verse in Song of Songs, I am my beloved and my beloved is mine, that indicates that the second half of the verse, my beloved is mine, in other words, God's reaching back down to us, right? God reaching out to us must also be present on some level, not just later, attributable to now, but also now in this month. In other words, the month of Elul must also include, in addition to us climbing the mountain, some form of God also reaching down to us. And the question is, in this month, there are no holidays in this month. It's not a holiday month. Rosh Hashanah, you can feel God's presence. You walk into synagogue, you feel something in the air. Yom Kippur, you feel something in the air. That's the divine radiance shining down on us. That's from above to below. You feel it in the air. You feel the energy. The month of Elul, though, you don't feel the energy typically. It's just us climbing. So where is the Vado Dili? Where is the my beloved is mine? I only feel my climbing. I don't feel God's reaching down. Where is that in the equation? This leads us to chapter 2. Let's jump straight in. Again, if we put away all of the discussion and the question and the answer and the one answer and then the rebuttal to the answer and we're still left with a question, if we put away all of the questions, we can hone in on one core point. We're trying to explain one thing. What is the energy of El all about? Is it just our efforts climbing to God, or is there also some form, some measure of God reaching out to us? God must also be reaching out to us in this month because of the Vidodi Li of the verse. What is that and how does that work? Here we go, chapter 2. Page 334. The Maimer, the discourse in Likutei Torah, which is this book right here. So the discourse in Likutei Torah continues, stating that Elul is a time when the 13 attributes of mercy are revealed. So last time we spoke about the 13 attributes of mercy a little bit. Basically, this is these 13 attributes of mercy are what we refer to as the place, the dimension from where forgiveness is drawn. So if a person violates, a person disregards an aspect of their spiritual relationship with God, so God forgives, God grants us mercy and forgiveness and allows us to reclaim the relationship with God, with Him, and that emanates from the 13 attributes of divine mercy. So after this goes back to the Bible, after one of the sins of the Jewish people, so God forgives, and these attributes are cited there in that context of forgiveness. The idea is that God is merciful, God is kind, God is patient, and it's from these attributes of divine mercy that forgiveness is born. If God did not, God forbid, if God did not possess these attributes of mercy, and we messed up, what would be the response? You messed up, you're out. That's it, forget about it. You violated the relationship, you unplugged, you disconnected, fine, so you're gone. But God has 13 attributes of divine mercy, and therefore there is forgiveness and we can always reclaim our place with God, etc. So what he says in the discourse, the Alter Rebbe says in the discourse, is that in the month of Elul, these 13 attributes of mercy are revealed. In other words, God is shining His love and compassion, mercy, forgiveness, patience with us. God is shining those upon us. Let's continue. Although the divine service of Elul is characterized by the verse, "I am my beloved's." In other words, it is an arousal from below. In other words, we are lifting up to God. So why are we saying now that God is shining these attributes of mercy upon us if it's all about our efforts and picking ourselves up by the bootstraps? Like we're climbing the mountain on our own, etc. So what does it mean that God is shining these 13 attributes of mercy? Nevertheless, this arousal from below initiated by man, by human beings, particularly when it comes from someone who is distant from godliness, is evoked by an arousal and a generation of potential from above, i.e. the revelation of the 13 attributes of mercy. So what he says in this discourse is the following. The month of El is characterized by our own divine service. And yet, the ability that we have to engage in this process of introspection, it's all because of a gift that God gives us. You see the duality. It's still us, but our climb is enabled by God as well. Again, you have different dimensions. So the experience of the Exodus, Passover, it's not at all us. It's God saying, okay, you're out of Egypt. God is airlifting us out. God is doing all the lifting. The month of El is us doing the heavy lifting. We're being introspective. We're thinking about our lives and where our station, our spiritual station in life, our successes, our failures, what we need to improve, etc. It's us climbing the mountain. But what he introduces right now is that although it's us, even though it's us, you still need the ability to do so. You still need something that helps you do that or that allows you to see that you can do that, that inspires you on some level to begin that journey on your own. You're still doing it on your own. You're still climbing the mountain. But something has to inspire you to do that. And those are the 13 attributes of mercy. The 13 attributes of mercy are shining, and that allows you and I to climb the mountain on our own. So it's not God picking us up, airlifting us to the top of the mountain. It's not the, you know, those things that take you, the chairlifts. We're not being lifted up and being just dropped on top of the mountain. It's us climbing, and we may not get to the top. But how do we have the inspiration to climb? Or how do we feel like we have the ability to climb? That comes from God shining his 13 attributes of mercy. In other words, when God radiates divine light upon us, either it can lift us up, or it can give us some measure of confidence for us to lift ourselves up. The former is Passover, the latter is El. Yeah.
But God's intervention is just a temporary
spot. Yes. Well,
is there anything we can do to prolong it?
We don't want to prolong it. In El, we don't want to prolong it. We don't want to prolong the artificial, the outside stimuli. What we want to do, the month of El, it's all about us doing the hard work, looking inside. What am I good at? What am I not so good at spiritually? Like, what do I need to improve on? What are the practical steps I'm going to take to do this? It's really about deep introspection. It's about really looking within and doing the hard work. It's about us. But sometimes to do that, you need some sort of you know, kick, some sort of push, a little bit, just to get you going.
It's so, like a divine adrenaline rush.
Yeah, but it's not too much that God is doing the work. But it's enough to get us to do the work. It's like, how do you motivate someone to be self-motivated? You know what I mean? That's literally what we're talking about. Let's use that phrase. El is self-motivation. Passover is divine motivation. God's lifting you up. God's rescuing you. That's not you. That's God rescuing you. El is self-motivated. But sometimes to be self-motivated, you need a kick in the pants to be self-motivated, right? You need something to get you self-motivated. It's like the person that walks into the bookstore and says to the person in the bookseller, where's the self-help section? And they say, if I told you, wouldn't that be self-defeating? Wouldn't that defeat the purpose, right? I'm going to tell you where the self-help is. Self-help is all about helping yourself. Anyway, it's a joke. The point is that sometimes to help yourself, you do need a little bit of something to get you going. Not too much that we would say it's no longer you. We still want it to be you, right? We don't want it to not be you. We don't want it to be God, because then it's not El. It's got to be you to be El. El is all about you and I doing the work, self-motivated.
It's like teaching a child to ride a bike. You just give him a push, and then he's on his own.
And then they fall, joking. Right, so, right, ideally, if they're a quick learner, you just give them a quick, right, you hold on a little bit. And
that's why God created that team.
Right, exactly. Water wings, yeah. Yeah. Yes. They get used to it. Yeah, it's like the floaties for the kids in the water, right? So they're learning how to swim, sort of, but not really. What we want to do is we're really trying to strike a fine balance between it being totally us, but also a little bit generated by God, but not too generated by God, because then it's God doing it. It's still us doing it. But God has to do a little bit to get us to do it. It's the classic question. How do you inspire someone? Not how do you do their work? Because you doing their work is easy. You just do their work, right? That's easy. So you want it done and they're not doing it, so you do it for them? Fine. But how do you inspire someone that they should do it?
Training?
But they still have to do it. If you end up doing it, they didn't do it. God saved us from Egypt. We didn't do it. We didn't pull ourselves out. God had to do that. El is, though, us saving. I don't want to be too dramatic. Saving ourselves. It's us lifting ourselves up. But how do you inspire someone who needs that type of, you know, climbing? Someone who someone who's not in a good spot, who needs to lift themselves up, but they're not doing it. So you could rescue them. But that's not going to work. It's not going to last. They need to rescue themselves. But they don't see it because they're stuck.
But what if you showed this is where you are now, this is where you could be? So
you could.
I don't. You say, well, what do I need to do?
Okay, fine. So what we're saying here is that God, in this month, God gives us a little bit of a vision of what we could be, a little bit of a push, a little love. Divine 13 attributes of mercy. What does that mean directly? God loves us and God forgives us and God's kind and generous to us and God's patient with us. 13 attributes of mercy shining in the month of El means the overarching message is not the God saying no, it's the God saying, I love you. Right? I love you. I really love you. And I'm patient with you. And I'm compassionate and kind. So that might also stir a person and motivate a person to get down to work, to get the work done. But the point is, El is all about our work. So whenever we talk about also there being a divine revelation, we have to minimize the divine revelation that it's not overshadowing the modality of avoda, of service. Because it has to be our service, even if there's also a little bit of divine attributes of mercy happening as well. So take a look at this. Take a look, 334, where we left off, second to the last paragraph from the bottom. The revelation of these 13 attributes of mercy in El is extended to every member of the Jewish people, even those most distant from God. In other words, this inspiration that is not rescuing the person, but it's inspiring a person to lift themselves up. This is extended to every single one, even the one who is the most distant. And that's going to be very, very important soon. 335, it generates, and look at the phrase, it generates potential from above that enables the service of I am my beloveds on the part of the Jewish people, whatever their spiritual standing. In other words, it's giving the possibility for the person on their own to lift themselves up. It's almost like without the 13 attributes of mercy, a person wouldn't even see it as a possibility to lift themselves up. But once there's the 13 attributes of mercy, then the person says, wait a second, I can lift myself up. And then they get down to work on their own to lift themselves up. Nevertheless, primarily, the revelation of El merely generates the potential, i.e. it is not a revelation that actually evokes or arouses man's service. In other words, that revelation of El from above is not one that makes you do it, because then it's God doing it again. But rather, it's one that is subtle enough that you're doing it. I want to give you an example. Let's talk about kids. How do you motivate a child to clean his room or her room? How do you motivate? Take away their iPhone. Okay. So that's one. But then I'll ask you the question. Or let's speak about a positive way. Let's say you give them, what would you give them? Depends on the age. Give me something. Doesn't matter what it is. What are you giving them? Candy. Fine. Simple. Candy, right? Clean your room. A little kid, clean your room, you get a candy. Let me ask you a question. Who cleaned the room?
The motivation of the candy.
The candy cleaned the room. The child cleaned the room, but did the child really clean the room? The child didn't clean the room. Let me ask you a question. Would the child have cleaned the room without the candy? But let's say I'm setting up a scenario where the child will not clean the room without a candy. So let's say I'm giving you that scenario. In other words, what I want to present, maybe it's not a good example, but what I want to present is a scenario where somebody is doing something, but it's not really them that's doing it. They're only doing it either under duress, take away the iPhone, or because of such a wonderful reward, they can't say no. But it's not really them. It's not really coming from them. And therefore, if you take away either the pain or the pleasure, they'll revert back to where they were, which is not cleaning the room. That's like the high, the artificial high. And when it comes back down, it remains the status quo, right? The child, if the child is not a room cleaner and doesn't value that cleanliness as a value, if that's not a value to the child yet, right? So the artificial encouragement, right, whether it's the carrot or the stick, is just getting an action out of the child, but it's not transforming the child from within. Maybe eventually it could through repeated action, huh? Maybe eventually it could. So maybe that's where the analogy is not a perfect analogy. But really what I'm trying to get to is sometimes somebody could be doing something, but it's not really them that's doing it. It's the motivation speaking or acting. Right, it's the reward doing it or the punishment doing it. It's not really them. It's like somebody twisting your arm and saying, "Well, say this." So I'll say it, but it's not really. I don't really want to say it. You're forcing me to say it. So the point is like this: Elul is about our divine service. It's about you and I reaching up to God. If God is seducing us and saying, look, you're going to get so much stuff, just love me, it's not really us who are loving. It's because of the reward. Or if God says, be careful, you have to love me or else, again, it's still not us doing it. The month of El is supposed to be us climbing closer to God on our own accord. It's supposed to be us doing it for us, because of us, motivated by us, for us. It's about us getting close to God. If God is too heavy-handed in influencing us, then it's no longer us, it becomes God. So that's why the fine line that we're straddling here in this text is the month of El is a time that the 13 attributes of divine mercy are shining. So there, God is influencing, but we have to minimize the influence, because if it's too heavy, if that influence is too strong, then it's not us that's doing the work. We're not doing the work, right? Our avoda, our work in El, consists of us responding to God's love. That's still not us. So it has to be subtle enough where it's there, but it's not influencing us. That's why he says it's just giving the possibility for us to do the work. It's almost like God saying, if you do the work, I'm here for you. It's opening the door for us, but not pushing us through. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Teaching a toddler to walk, right? You reach out to them. You're kind of like, if you take those first few steps,
I'm here for you.
Meet you halfway,
right. Kind of thing, right. Okay. I like that. So in other words, God is saying, if you walk through that door, I'm here for you. I love you. Unconditionally. That's what the 13 attributes of mercy are. No matter what you've done, God says, forgiving, kind, patient, loving, I'm here for you. It's not that God is saying, come, let's go. It's not like God is grabbing us by the hand. That wouldn't be us then. It would be God leading the way. El needs to be us, because then it's not El. El is us walking, but God is receiving, making himself available if we walk. Knowing that he's available can give us a little bit of a boost for us to walk on our own. You know what the funny thing is about when parents teach their kids how to walk? So you hold out your hands, or your hug, whatever it is, and the child begins, you know, that process, falls again and again and again, and then gets a little bit closer. What does the parent do inevitably? Step back. Right, the child, just as the child's about to get close, well, not maybe not the first time, but eventually, right, you keep on moving back a little bit to get the child to walk more and more and more, right? Because you want to teach a child how to move. Sometimes God also seems like a moving target. Like, I was just there. Like, I thought I was just going to get close to God. What?
It's the same thing riding a bike.
Yeah.
The little boy or the little girl thinks that the mommy or the daddy's
still holding on.
Bike,
little do they know they're on their own. Right. So what we're trying to find subtly is a balance between God opening the door for us, but not pushing us through. Because if God pushes us through, then it's the Exodus again. It's the same story of God rescuing us from our troubles. And El is not about God's rescue. That's Passover. Passover is God rescuing us. Passover is God saying, you're stuck. You're not in a good place. Divine intervention, plucking you out. I'm saving you. That's Passover. El is us doing the work. It's us climbing the mountain. But for that also, we still need a little bit of divine help. You had some. That's exactly it. Although the 13 attributes are shining, they're shining in a very subtle way where blink and you'll miss it. Because if the volume of those attributes were turned a little bit higher, it would be too big a push. It wouldn't be us anymore. That's why the attributes are shining, but it's the volume is low, that it's so subtle that it's only like, I know that if I put in the effort, God still loves me, so let me do it, but I'm doing it. If it's a little bit higher, if God's saying too many times, I love you, I love you, I love you, then when we say I love you too, it's us responding to God. And we don't want, this is not a responsive month. This is us initiating. This is Anila Dodi Vidodili. This is us initiating. But even when we initiate, the message here is God also precedes that with a little bit of a, at least a door open for us to initiate. By the way, it's a very subtle balance, which is why we have the parable of the king in the field. In other words, here's what you need to know. I'm setting this up for next time. The whole parable of the king in the field is all to explain this subtlety, how you have us doing the work, but God influencing it a little bit, but not too much. That whole balance is straight up the king in the field. Let's do a little bit more. Let's do a little bit more here and finish section number two. We are in the middle of page 335, right in the middle. The service itself of Elul, in other words, the avoda, the spiritual service in this month, comes from man's initiative. I am my beloveds. It comes from us. Let's continue. Page 336. Middle of the page. Indeed, this emphasis on man's own service is what constitutes the advantage of the divine service of El over the divine service of the 10 days of tshuva, the 10 days of repentance, which are between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, including Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Those 10 days are what we call the 10 days of teshuva. During the 10 days of teshuva, and particularly on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur themselves, the revelation of godliness is so powerful that it arouses man, and man's divine service comes in response to the revelation from above. In other words, if you feel like you're praying on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and you're really into it, is that really you, or is that because of the magnitude of the day? That's probably because of the magnitude of the day. In other words, it's God pushing you. It's God, it's you doing it. You're showing up, you're praying. You got the prayer book in front of you. You're meditating on whatever it is, and you're fasting, and you're doing that. But come on, it's God pushing you. It's the magnitude of the day that's really driving that, right? The fundamental, but that's Tishrei. Elul is about us. The fundamental expression and the positive dimension of man's divine service, which is service on one's own initiative, you and I lifting ourselves up and doing the hard work, which is I am my beloved's, which is me reaching out to God, that is manifest through the divine service of Elul. So in other words, we need to keep the lines clearly drawn. When it comes to the high holidays themselves, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the days in between, when it comes to that time of that time period, in 30 days from now, God will be pushing us. God will be pulling us and pushing us and inspiring us, whatever. This month, it's about us doing the hard work. And yet we say, the Alter Rebbe explains in this discourse, in the original discourse, Ani L'Dodi, the Alter Rebbe says, even when it's us, there's a little bit of God there also. Not so much that God is pushing us or pulling us or carrying us or right, not to that extent, but enough that God is, even at, on the most subtle level, opening the door for us and saying, if you walk in, I am here. But you need to do the walking. We need to do the walking. Does that make sense? So in summation, let's just summarize the first two chapters of the discourse, which will lead to the king in the field parable next time. To summarize, we have the month of Elul is marked by the acronym, I am my beloved's, my beloved is mine. We said, though, that El is really I am my beloved's, not the second half of the verse. My beloved is mine is, that's when God inspires, but I am my beloved's is really El, which then we ask the question, so why is the whole verse contained in the month of El? And we don't have an answer to that yet. What we then explained, that's really the technical question, and I know it's technical, and there's a lot of Hebrew there and Hebrew acronyms, so we can leave that aside. The main point of the discussion that we entered into was that Elul is a time in which it's our divine service. It's up to us to lift ourselves up. But even for that, the Alter Rebbe explains, God radiates a very low level, if you will, of God's 13 attributes of mercy not to inspire us, but to guide, create the possibility for us to be self-driven. So God wants us to be self-motivated. If he tells us to be self-motivated, then it's ruined already, because he's telling us to be self-motivated. So he's telling us to do it. Still can't do that. So it has to be very subtle opening to allow us to take the initiative on our own. And for this, we have the king in the field. Next time. Thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and Coffee.